Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please be sure to turn off your cell phones and other devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming Grown-Ups Forum events. On Thursday, June 21st, Dr. Brian Kennedy, CEO of the Buck Institute, speaks on the research and teamwork behind the Buck's breakthrough discoveries, extending the healthy years so getting older doesn't have to mean getting ill. On Tuesday, July 24th, attorney John E. O'Grady will discuss age-old estate planning questions raised in classic film clips. In his popular educational seminar, Estate Planning in Film. Where else can you get legal advice and a glass of wine for $8? These are just two of many upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Before we proceed, I want to proudly introduce you to the groups that have worked in association with the Grown-Ups Forum to bring this program by Mark Friedman. First, the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Transition Network is a part of a national organization where women 50 and over inspire and support one another through small groups, programs, and events as they explore and experience transitions in their professional and personal lives. Also, Coming of Age Bay Area celebrates the ability of men and women age 50 plus to continue to grow, transform their communities, and become a force for public good. We offer Explore Your Future workshops, community events, and extraordinary volunteer opportunities for people 50 plus. And the third group that's helped us put this program together is San Francisco Village. San Francisco Village is a nonprofit membership organization that empowers older adults to continue living in the homes and the neighborhoods they love by providing the community support and services to remain independent, connected, and fully engaged as they age. Before we go on, I'd like to introduce Arlene Reif, who's with the Transition Network, and she'll recognize the other leadership here. Arlene?
Yeah. Oh, it's just so wonderful to see so many of you here for what I know is going to be a very inspirational and thought-provoking talk by Mark Friedman. It's been a pleasure to co-sponsor with the Commonwealth Club of California, our three organizations working together. And I'd like to invite you at the end of the program to come and take a look at the materials we have. Doreen McCune from Coming of Age, could you just stand up so they can recognize you? Right. And there are several people from the Transition Network, and we have materials from the San Francisco Village, too. So I'd like to welcome you and thank you, John, for giving us this opportunity to collaborate with you.
Thank you, Arlene. Welcome. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Mark Friedman, as many of you are aware, is founder and CEO of Civic Ventures, an award-winning social entrepreneur, frequent commentator in the national media, and author of The Big Shift, Encore, Prime Time, and The Kindness of Strangers. Friedman spearheaded the the creation of Experience Corps, and the Purpose Prize. He lives in San Francisco with his family, and we now welcome him to our podium. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, John, and thanks to the Transition Network, Coming of Age, the San Francisco Villages, and to all of you for coming out this evening. I'm shocked to see so many faces and a little daunted by the prospect. I'm talking tonight since the paperback version of The Big Shift has just been issued. The book came out about a year ago. And for me, it was a more personal book than the others that John mentioned. I turned 50 just before I started writing the book. And around that time, I came across a wonderful Joseph Campbell quote who said that midlife is when you get to the top of the ladder and discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. A sobering quote to encounter as your AARP card arrives in the mailbox. That card did arrive in the mailbox, and I decided that since this was midlife, it might be a good time to take a step back and maybe even take a break after decades of working hard. And I managed to convince my board to let me take all of my vacation time at once and go on a three-month, I had accumulated a lot of vacation, on a three-month sabbatical to Australia. I don't know why Australia, but it was far away, and it seemed like a place where you might be able to get a different perspective on things. So I ended up using every frequent flyer mile I could find and booking tickets for myself, my wife, our two kids. I had a 2- and a 4-year-old at the time. And we prepared to go to the other end of the planet. And a week before we were about to depart, I realized that I actually had no desire whatsoever to go to Australia for 3 months. And that the antithesis of a sabbatical was month after month, day after day, in a small hotel room with two screaming children. So I decided to do an about-face, even though I had purchased just about the entire oeuvre of travel books ever written about Australia, New Zealand. And I called United Airlines, and for a mere $1,000, they gave me my frequent flyer miles back. And instead of feeling like my dream was dashed, that I'd never be able to take a break till I ultimately could retire, which seemed decades in the future given the age of our kids, I felt euphoria, a great sense of relief. There'd be no strip search at SFO. I'd be free of coming back to that mass of phone calls and emails. Think of all the money we'd save. And so I started telling a friend who said, oh, yeah, you know, that it turns out there's now a body of research in psychology about exactly this question. Turns out that one of the great sources of happiness in life is planning a fantastic trip and then ditching it at the very last minute. You get all the anticipation with none of the problems. But I figured you had to do something. So I said, okay, we'll take a car trip up to Portland. That seemed manageable. My wife was, Leslie, was keen on the idea, and I'm back at the computer planning away, and I realized that we couldn't make it all the way to Portland with the kids. We'd have to stop in Medford, Oregon, and I found the hotel in Medford, Oregon that had the best rate. I called them up, and I was testing out various discounts when I suddenly realized I had a new discount. Turns out the AARP rate was the lowest of any. I managed to save us $14 at the Homewood Suites, and it was a momentous trip. Our 2-year-old took his first steps on the carpet of the hotel. But anyway, I rush out to tell Leslie about this great negotiation that I had just managed to engineer. She still remembered the $1,000 that we had paid for not going to Australia and was unimpressed with the $14 discount. And she acidly said, you got the cribs too, right? So I had to call back the 18-year-old desk clerk. I said, hello, this is Mr. Friedman. Mr. Senior Citizen Discount Friedman? Yeah, it's can I have two cribs? In that moment, you know, I had visions of arriving at the Homewood Suites and the entire cast of the FBI, right? You know, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. would be disinterred and arrest me for fraud at the door for this combination of discounts and cribs. No such thing happened, but it did make me realize that I had joined a larger group of people. I suspect some of you are part of that category. The oxymoronic years. You remember oxymorons from grade school, you know, Stephen Douglas, the little giant, this contradictions in terms. You see it all the time for so many people who are moving into this phase of life, right? The young old, the working retired. There was a Newsweek cover last year about the walking dead, talking about 50-something men in the business world and this job situation. So maybe AARP Discount and Two Cribs joins the linguistic cohort. But I think there is a great deal of confusion about what your identity is as you move into this period in life. I recently had breakfast with a guy who'd been head of CBS News, you know, talk about being at the top of the ladder in midlife. And he told me he now thinks of himself as part of the PIP squad. And so, of course, you know, I leaned towards him and asked him what that is, previously important person. And then he said something to me that's continued to resonate. He said, you know, the world's done with us. It's just that we're not done with the world. And I was really moved by that. But I think that there is a lot of chaos and confusion around this period. And I picked up an editorial that was written the other day in the Huffington Post about a new film, Late Bloomers, starring Isabella Rossellini and William Hurt. And it included an interview with Isabella Rossellini, who in a matter of weeks or months, I can't remember which, is about to turn 60. And she said, there's no place for people who are 60 to 80. And I don't think she meant a geographic place, a physical place, but a psychic place. Where are you when you're in this period between midlife and true old age? I see it all the time around us, right? 60's the new 30, right? We're supposed to, the place is supposed to be a second youth. Or, as I discover as I walk up to Pharmaca on Solano Avenue in Berkeley, my pharmacy, and there's a sign at the door that says, senior citizens 60 and older, make sure to claim your discount. So 60's the new 90 at the same time it's the new 30. There is a sense of a period which is kind of half what has passed and half of what's yet to come, a sort of split difference, oftentimes a contradictory one. And if there's problems at the level of individual identity, it's magnified societally, right? You know, there's an enormous investment that's going into living longer, you know, and you see it everywhere in the medical research that's coming out. You hear it when you go to your doctor. They tell you to reduce your stress and eat your cruciferous vegetables, whatever they are, walk around the block, live well so that you can live long. Then you go out to the waiting room and open the newspaper, and there's the op-ed piece where we hear about walkers outnumbering strollers. We hear about dependency ratios, the gray tsunami, the age quake. It's almost as if the Weather Channel has sponsored the entire demographic revolution. And so how is it exactly that the best thing that ever happened to us as individuals, these longer lives, you know, life expectancy 47, 100 years ago, now edging towards the mid-80s with projections of upward increases in the decades ahead. So how is it that this great personal triumph, individual triumph, that we're all supposed to be pursuing diligently and responsibly is a collective calamity, right? As a society tilted heavily towards more older people ends up bringing down posterity, taking America to the cleaners. It's confusing. It's confusing in the same way that the identity question is confusing. And it raises a challenge in that the inevitable rush of all these tens of millions of boomers and even longer lived younger generations is going to happen. It's inexorable, inevitable. How can we make the most of it? I was tickled a few years ago by Christopher Buckley's book, Boomsday. Some of you probably read it. Maybe he even spoke here. He had one solution in that book, euthanasia for boomers at age 70. You know, their families get iPods, and it's not likely to be politically feasible, but it is one alternative to the current situation. Another one is proposed by a film that's about to come out. It will arrive next week, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, and it's an all-star cast of British stars led by Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Tom Wilkinson, includes Dev Patel, the star of Slumdog Millionaire, and it's about outsourcing the elderly. Dev Patel restores portrays having restored a former palace in India, which is going to be a grand new environment for the elderly, and he beckons older people from countries like the UK and the United States who feel rejected in their own community to come to a place where they can have a new home and a new life. There's a wonderful story when one of these people, right, Penelope Wilton, who was the star of Downton Abbey, you may remember her from that. She's complaining about the disrepair of Marigold Hotel, and Dev Patel joyfully says to her, "Oh, you know, here in India we have an expression: everything will work out in the end. So if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end." Which I think could well be the mantra for the story that I'm about to tell you tonight. I think, you know, maybe there is some serious concern about what's going to happen as we go through this demographic transformation. Maybe it isn't working out as well as it should, but that doesn't mean it's the end. It doesn't mean demography's destiny, and that destiny is a disastrous one. The solution is really in our hands, and it's as much about the nature of later life as all these numbers that we hear about, 10,000 people a day turning 60, you know, tens of millions of boomers flooding into this new period. And I want to argue that we have an opportunity to create a new stage of life between the middle years and retirement and old age. Essentially, that 60 is not the new 30 anymore, than it's the new 90, that 60 is the new 60, and this great migration of millions heading in that direction are something entirely new on the landscape. And the sooner we can recognize that and begin shaping it in a way that works well for those individuals, for those individuals coming on their heels who will soon be entering that stage, for society more broadly, the better we'll all be. Now, it sounds odd to talk about inventing a new stage of life. Stages of life seem like fixtures, like the oxygen in the air. They seem like the seasons, right? You don't just put a new season in between, you know, summer and fall, and the Five Seasons Hotel, right? I walked right by it over here. That's not going to happen. So how is it that you do something like that? It seems like a crime against the rules of the universe. But in fact, stages of life are fictions. They're utterly unnatural inventions, always have been, always will be. They seem like they've been there forever, but in most cases, they've just been there for a short while. There was no childhood in this country before the beginning of the 18th century. I discovered in trying to understand the origins of retirement in America, particularly the golden years version of retirement, that's a half century old. Even Social Security, as we know, which really promoted mass retirement, was created in the mid-1930s using the age of 65, an arbitrary selection based on the eligibility age of the Prussian military pension from the 1880s. You know, when Otto von Bismarck picked 65, convinced that the state would never pay a single pension, right? You know, this is life expectancy was in the, he was 78 or something at the time, but he didn't count himself as part of the rabble. There's a wonderful economist at Stanford, a guy by the name of John Chauvin, who said, you'd never use numbers, dollars from 1935 without inflation adjusting them to 2012. You know, no self-respecting economist will do that. And yet here we are using 1935 numbers to equate old age. He actually has a radical suggestion. He thinks we should measure life from the end, not the beginning. How you actually do that, I'm not quite sure. But so we concoct this idea of old age being at 65, pass out the first Social Security check in January of 1942, a retired bookkeeper in Ludlow, Vermont, a woman by the name of Ida May Fuller. She proceeds to live to 101. She pays $20.75 into the system. She gets $22,888.92 in return, and in a way becomes our first de facto lottery winner in the process. She watches the Beatles come to America, the moon landing, you know, just on and on. So, you know, already the handwriting was on the wall. And I'm a big fan and defender of Social Security, so I don't mean to, you know, to make that point. But even in the early 1940s, this notion of longevity was on the landscape. And in the late 1940s, Walter Reuther, the UAW leader, got up in front of his union in Milwaukee and described retirees as too old to work, too young to die. Essentially, in this ever-extending anteroom to the great beyond, a period where people really did not know what to do with themselves. There was a purpose gap. They were told by medical experts to rock aimlessly on the porch. And in a matter of about 10 years, we turned this, you know, this dreaded destination into something that people coveted, that became a centerpiece of the American dream, became the golden years. And we did it through marketing in the 1950s. We did it through the creation of places like Sun City, which coined the phrase the golden years, and also this idea of an active retirement. And it was a good thing. And it was an important development, and it served us well for 50 years. But many people are asking, you know, are 30-year retirements financially affordable as we live longer for us as individuals? Are they sustainable for the society? But it's a really powerful example of how we turned a push into a pull and how we turned a desert into a kind of destination. And it's not just in later life that we've invented these stages. As I said earlier, childhood was a concoction of an earlier century. We're now reading, the New York Times had a cover story in their magazine a year and a half ago about emerging adulthood, that this period of the 20s is becoming its own stage. All those young people who are moving back in with you, they're not failed adolescents or failed adults. They're actually emerging adults as we stretch. Talk about making virtue out of necessity. But as we, it does make sense, because as we stretch the lifespan from 70 to something that could approximate 50, you can't just stretch the existing stages of life. You've got to be more creative than that. And I think that's what's starting to happen. The most fascinating discovery for me in doing the research for this book was that adolescence was created almost exactly 100 years ago in 1904 by a 60-year-old. Youth was invented in America by a 60-year-old, and a 60-year-old by the name of Granville Stanley Hall, G. Stanley Hall, who was an extraordinary figure, a titanic figure in the history of American psychology. First PhD in psychology in America, he was a graduate student of William James. Started the first psychological lab in the country, started the American Journal of Psychology, started the American Psychological Association. He was John Dewey's thesis advisor, you know, pretty much every major figure in the first 30, 40 years of psychology in America had studied under Hall. He was also the person who brought Freud and Jung to America, and he was president of Clark University. He had them in this miserable Worcester house that he was living in. You know, the weather was horrible. Freud hated it. He took the first boat he could back. But he had actually Freud, Jung, and William James all living in this house. And you know that whole thing where the president and the vice president are never in the White House at the same time? So if this house had caught fire, you know, the unconscious would not exist. all those shingles, you know, that the therapists around the Bay Area are hanging out would be retracted. Hall wrote this book in 1904 at the age of 60, having survived a midlife crisis, arguing that all these young people who were leaving childhood but not quite at adulthood were not child adults in the oxymoronic formulation that, you know, we're using for all of us who are in our 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, but that they were something new. They were adolescents, and that they were in a period that should be a moratorium time, which gave young people extra time to grow up. And it caught on, and it caught on not for the reasons that Hall argued so much, but it caught on because as a society we were terrified of these young people. This idea of all these kids who had the physical maturity and strength of adults but the emotional immaturity of children at a time when the country seemed to be, you know, going through extraordinary upheaval, urbanization, immigration, huge changes in industrialization. Young people were being sentenced to high school in Missouri, right? You know, we were really worried about what was going to happen if these kids started running amok. So we created child labor laws and high schools. And 40 years later, in 1944, with the birth of 17 magazine, we invented the word teenager. So it takes a long time to do this. But it caught on because we didn't know what to do with these people, and we were worried what was going to happen if we didn't wrestle with that issue. So the amazing story about Hall, though, is not just, you know, this powerful example of an invention of a stage of life, but he actually invented a new stage of life between midlife and old age. He did it 20 years later in a sort of lost masterpiece. He was 80 himself, and he argued that all of these people, he said, I should have invented this stage of life, not adolescence, and God, was he right about that? But I, as the father of some soon-to-be teenagers, but he described the period beautifully, and you know, I talked earlier about how you don't just invent a season. Well, he described this period as an Indian summer, and he said that human beings didn't reach the height of their capacity until the shadows started slanting eastward. He had been class poet at Williams College, so he always had this poetic turn, and he described this beautiful vision of this period in life and then immediately dropped dead. And we lost the idea for 100 years, but it was really remarkable that the same person who created adolescence created this stage of life that I think we need to put into practice now. We need to do it not only because we have these beautiful visions like Hall's and also of a number of other scholars. Mary Catherine Bateson, in the daughter of Margaret Mead, wrote Composing a Further Life last year, a wonderful argument for doing just that. She calls this period adulthood too. She had an article in Harvard Business Review that influenced me as well. She said we'd stretch midlife so long that it had become a run-on sentence in desperate need of punctuation. And as I was thinking about my own sabbatical, I was thinking I needed, you know, it's definitely not a period. I needed something more than a comma. And then it hit me, the semicolon. And then I went in for my colonoscopy and realized that maybe this wasn't a marketing slogan that would have big dividends in a boomer audience. Whatever piece of punctuation it is, an interrobang or whatever. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, the former chair of the MacArthur Foundation Board, education professor at Harvard, calls this period the third chapter. So we're starting to get a vision for what this period could be like. The numbers are enormous, all those thousands and thousands of people every day hitting 60, moving beyond. There is this identity problem. How is it that you go through a period that could be as long as midlife in duration, unclear about what even success is, what to call yourself, a pip? And there are these questions of, you know, if we still try to shoehorn a 20th century conception of the life course into a demographic and longevity transformation that's a product of the 21st century, will it really work? Will it cause enormous conflict? So I think a whole set of reasons are mounting, but you always get to the question then how? How do you do it? And there Hall offers a sobering tale. I remember reading a critic of Hall's work on adolescence, saying G. Stanley Hall thought adolescence was going to take place in Valhalla when, in fact, it occurred in high school. You know? So you can get romantic about Indian summers and shadows slanting eastward, but then there's the reality. But before talking about the reality, I do think we need to develop a vision for this period, and I think it's possible to see in many people who are making the most of this period the contours of what we need as a society. That William Gibson, science fiction writer, says the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. And in the case of this new stage of life, there are really, I think, millions of people who are living out a beautiful version of it. Some of the people who've written about them, they talk about a time of continued growth, development, creativity, contribution, a period of life that's not a split difference of what came before and what's still ahead, something that has its own integrity. I think that the real essence, though, can be found in the question of time and the expansion and compression of time that so many people feel in this period. And to describe that, you know, I'll refer to Mary Catherine Bates again. She describes that the hallmark of this period as a kind of sweet spot, active wisdom. And by that, I think she really means that people have reached a point in life where they have new priorities, a different kind of perspective, and yet they actually have the time and the capacity to do something with that. You know, I always think, you know, never before have we had so many people with so much experience, so much know-how, and the chance to actually put that in practice, the time to do it. And I think in many ways the motivation to do it as well, because when you do hit this period in life, mortality just becomes a much more tangible part of your experience. You know, you don't think about that when you're 20 years old, but when you're 50, when you're 60, parents pass away, you read your reunion notes and not everybody's there. You read about Steve Jobs and it doesn't, if you feel as, wow, if this could happen to him, this could happen to me. You don't take time for granted in the same way that you once did. And that's a good thing. It matters more. Even Bill Gates, you know, I read an interview with him talking about his relationship with Steve Jobs and how Jobs' death had really shaken him up. And he talked about how when he left Microsoft, it wasn't about retirement, it was about reordering priorities. And I think a lot of people are reordering priorities in a way that makes sense. And yet at the same time, you realize that the road doesn't go on forever. There's the realization, you know, given all these gains in longevity, it might go on for quite a bit longer. And then you remember how fast the last 25 years went by, and you realize you better get going. And I think of that French Revolution slogan, equality, liberty, fraternity. Maybe this one is mortality, longevity, urgency. And if you throw demography into that, what happens when millions and millions of people are in that frame of mind? And the particular direction of that sense of purpose, I think, is naturally towards future generations, because most of the people who have written about what developmental success is in this period have argued that it was tied to the concept of generativity. When you realize that you aren't going to live forever, you do start asking questions of legacy about what of you will outlive the self. Eric Erickson said that the absolute distillation of development in this period of life could be encapsulated in the phrase, I am what survives of me. George Valen, a psychiatrist at Harvard, puts it differently, but basically says the same thing. He says biology flows downhill. And William James, G. Stanley Hall's mentor, he said the great use of life is to spend it for something that will outlast us. I think, you know, I could go on and quote and quote and quote from all of these people, but I think there's an essential truth, you know, mortality, longevity, urgency, and generativity. Still haven't said what we should call the stage of life, adulthood 2, the third chapter, the third age. We hear lots of different second acts. A week before the book was due at the publisher, I hadn't come up with a name. I was using stage 3, which a friend of mine who'd been a breast cancer writer, that was not. I didn't even try on the semicolon on her. I asked my estimable mother-in-law, Donna. We found ourselves poised over a laundry hamper. She came to help us out as I was in the final writing throes. And I said, Donna, you know, she's somebody who does the crossword puzzle in a matter of minutes. Can you help me out here? I'm absolutely desperate. You know, what should we call this period? She's well into her 60s. Oh, I figured that out long ago. Why didn't you ask me earlier? And she said, I talk to my sister about it all the time. So I said, Donna, you know, well, what is it? What's the essence? I'm on my next to last dog. The way she figures it, she has had about 6 years left on Jack, who was part German Shepherd, part Dachshund. Then she figured, you know, she'd get a midsize for another 14 years, and it's not like she's going to be measured for a casket at that point, but, you know, you got to clean up after it. It's a lot of mess. So, I'm more used to measuring life in dog years, so I thought maybe she's onto something here. In fact, I then went and checked out the website of Thomas Pearls, the foremost expert on centenarians, and he has a quiz there. I filled in all her information. Turns out she's going to live to 97. I announced this to her, and she immediately went and filled out the and got 96 and told me she knew things about, you know, her life that I shouldn't. So. And then the craziest thing happened. The dog died. So I may have to recalculate. She may have two dogs in her, but whatever we call this period, canine or otherwise, I think we are getting to a point. Shakespeare said there were seven stages of life, and as we, you know, move from 70 to something approximate 5, I think we're getting to seven stages: childhood, adolescence, emerging adulthood, the middle years. And there's a lot of wonderful writing and research on that, including Patricia Cohen's book In Our Prime that came out a few months ago. This encore period, that's the label we've ended up assigning to it, retirement and old age. And so if we go back to the drawing board and divide up life in a way I think that makes more sense, we're going to come up with more stages, and that's one proposition around what they might look like. But we're going to have to do more than develop names and labels and visions and mortality, longevity, urgency, and all those kinds of attempts to be witty about this stuff. We need new social institutions. I mean, just look at what we did with retirement in the last 50 years and later life in this country in the last 75. You know, I told the story about Sun City and retirement communities, about the invention of Social Security. We created AARP, Elder Hostel, the Older Americans Act, Medicare, senior centers. I could go on and on, but it's been an extraordinary time of innovation. And because of that, later life has really become a much more rich and fulfilling time in life, something that people could genuinely look forward to. It wasn't just that the marketers wanted them to look forward to it. There was payoff in that promise. And I think we're going to have to be just as creative about this period that's opening up, that doesn't yet have a name. And I think the place to start is around the transition into this phase of life. That's why it's wonderful to be sponsored tonight by the Transition Network and by Coming of Age, and groups that are really creating new kinds of rites and routes of passage for this great midlife migration of people who are moving into another period, and frankly, in most cases, have never had time to think about this. First of all, the landscape's changing. Second, everybody's so busy in the middle years raising kids, working long hours, that it's hard to think about what lies ahead. It shouldn't be an individual do-it-yourself proposition when you have so many people moving in this direction. It has to be something that's done more efficiently, more sensibly. I think one of the areas where creativity is needed is around education. You know, in the last 30, 40 years, as I was saying, we invented lifelong learning. It was an extraordinary triumph, beginning with Elder Hostel. And so now we have education for young people, education for older people. I think we need education for people who are moving into this as of yet unnamed stage. And to buttress that claim, I've got a wonderful quote that I just learned about from none other than Carl Jung. He said, and this was decades and decades ago, "Wholly unprepared, people embark upon the second half of life. Or are there perhaps colleges for 40-year-olds which prepare them for their coming life and its demands, as the ordinary colleges introduce our young people to a knowledge of the world and of life? No, there are none. Thoroughly unprepared, we take the step into the afternoon of life. Worse still, we take the step with the false presupposition that our truths and ideas will serve us as hitherto. But we cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning, for what was great in the morning will be little at evening, and what in the morning was true will at evening have become a lie." So how do we prepare for who we're going to be next every bit as much as what we're going to do. And I'm happy to see that there are a bunch of education innovations, you know, some of them very much in the upper reaches. Harvard's created something called the Advanced Leadership Initiative by Rosabeth Cantor, who talked here at the Commonwealth Club a year ago. It's essentially a new kind of education for the second half of life, but it's over $50,000, so you really have to be a captain of industry to get involved in something of that. So community colleges, though, are doing much more. There's now a startup in California by Sherry Lansing, who's the chair of the Board of Regents for the University of California, and Steve Poisner, who was the insurance commissioner, called initially the Encore Career Institute. It's now changed its name to Empower Ed. It's going to be launching in the fall. UCLA is the key partner. All the curriculum for these one-year courses, which will be on the iPad, are approved by the UCLA Faculty Senate. There are other wild things happening, like there's a theological seminary in Milwaukee, actually Hales Corners, Wisconsin, which specializes in second career priests, men who are widowers, who go into the priesthood. So, you know, there's a lot of ferment underway. I think just as much as a new kind of school for the second half of life, we need to create internships for grown-ups. This has become a great passion of mine. In the writing of the book, I spent a bunch of time describing the odyssey of a woman in Denver, Paula Lopez Crespin, whose daughter went in to Teach for America and had such an extraordinary experience. Paula recalls being in a Los Angeles classroom watching her daughter teach and having this epiphany that she wanted to do the same thing. She joins Teach for America. She ends up in a dorm room in Houston in July. It's 112 degrees, and she's sharing a bathroom down the hall with three 22-year-olds. So some people are doing it. John Kerr, another person I wrote about, wanted to go from being a development person at WGBH in Boston to working in the conservation world. He ended up joining the Student Conservation Association internship program. He was 65. The oldest person in the program was 19. But he made it through, and now he is a park ranger in the northeast corner of Yellowstone. He has a hat, a badge. He tries to stay between people and bears. So there are some people just by sheer force of will and ingenuity are pulling it off. But I think we need to do better than rappelling down the back wall or sneaking in the side, that we need to create front doors for all these people who are moving in this direction. At Civic Ventures, we've launched something called the Encore Fellowship. It's a 9-month, half-time, $25,000 passage for people who want to move into work in the environment, in health, in education, to have what we've been calling an encore career, which is kind of a hybrid between the spirit of service and the practicality of continued income and health insurance. It's taking off. In the fall, Intel announced that every single retirement-eligible U.S. employee who wants to do an Encore Fellowship and gets placed will be paid for by Intel. They'll pay COBRA coverage during the period, help support the program administratively. They're making it not a philanthropic initiative, but a human resource policy. How many places do you hear about more generous human resource policies being enacted? So I think the HR folks there, and I think in many other places, realize that, you know, people who've been the company for 25 years who are being moved out or are moving out themselves are not ready for retirement. Giving them the speech about retirement planning is not going to connect with where they're at this juncture in life. They need help making a transition. I could go on and on about other opportunities, but we've got to figure out how to pay for this. We did a study in the fall that showed that for people who did this do-it-yourself process, it was 18 months, in some cases 24 months, very little income, oftentimes expenses. Time Magazine had a story last year about the doubling of people over 50 going to divinity school. And it had a great title, Holy Enrollers. I thought, whoever came up with that title gets to take the weekend off. But the woman they feature had been a pediatric nurse in Florida. She became an Episcopal priest, cost her $100,000. She had to sell her house and car. Why not have individual purpose accounts to go along with those individual retirement accounts to help people plan for this transition? Why not be able to have take a year or two of Social Security in your 50s or even early 60s to go from being a Episcopal priest to a pediatric nurse or the other direction or whatever the transition is, and agree to work an actuarially adjusted period later before you get your full benefits. I think that there's a whole set of innovations that are just beginning to be explored. If we pull this off, I think we can turn that paradox that I talked about earlier, good for individuals, bad for the country, into a payoff, into the longevity bonus as opposed to the longevity paradox. We can unleash an extraordinary windfall of talent. We did a study in the fall also that showed 31 million people give moving into an Encore career an 8, 9, or 10. And the average length of time of those careers is just under 10 years. If we just got half of those people, help them move from aspiration to action, to do what they already want to do, no proselytizing required, that's 150 million years of service dedicated to the biggest social challenges of our time. This is really akin to discovering a lost continent, to the discovery of women as a major productive force in the labor market in the 60s and 70s. Of course, it's the same women who are moving to this juncture now, as our friends at the Transition Network would be quick to tell us. I think in the process of doing it, we can take this unsustainable situation, right? You know, why write people off prematurely when they're at the height of their capacity and create something that will work not just now, but for future generations. Half the children born since 2000 in the developed world will see their 100th birthday. This is not about the baby boomers. This is about creating a new stage of life, a new pattern of life, a new shape of life that will make sense for much longer lives. And I'll just close with one of my favorite quotes. We at Civic Ventures give out a prize for innovators in the second half of life called the Purpose Prize. One of the winners a few years ago was a guy named Robert Chambers in New Hampshire. And he got summoned to the White House last year as this paragon of entrepreneurship, showing that innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship are hardly the exclusive province of young people. Marcy Adelman, who's here tonight, was one of the other winners. And when Robert got to the White House and got to stand next to the president, he said, "I was old enough to know injustice when I saw it and experienced enough to do something about it." And all I can say is amen. Thank you.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Mark Friedman, author of The Big Shift. I know there are questions, Mark, so what we'd like to do is pass the mic, and I'm wondering, Arlene, would you take that mic and pass it to people on that side of the room, and we'll pass on this side of the room. Will you take questions?
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
Delighted.
Thank you.
Hi. You know, I'm just curious about popular culture. What are they saying about all of this? Have you been, you know, hearing about that, or where are we with that group?
You know, there's been a lot of concern that television, films, particularly television, not keeping up with the changes that are happening because they're so focused on a younger demographic for their advertising. But I've really been heartened over the last year or two at signs. How many of you saw Men of a Certain Age on TV, right? Wonderful. And what struck me about it is that, you know, here's a guy, Ray Romano, who's embracing this certain age period and really trying to deal with it in a serious way. There was actually a wonderful show that only lasted two episodes with John Lithgow a few years before, called 20 Good Years. It's about John Lithgow and Jeffrey Tambor, who really look at the actuarial table and realize they've got, you know, the longevity part of the mortality, longevity, and urgency equation, and try to figure out what to do with it. In film, there are major movies that have been coming out. I talked about The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel coming out next week, Late Bloomers, which is out now. I saw on a plane Larry Crown last year with Tom Hanks playing a late 50-something cook who goes to community college and, you know, tries to create a new life, meets Julia Roberts in the process and falls in love with her. There are really a lot of serious efforts that are beginning to emerge around this. I wanted to say that with the Marigold Hotel, we're working together with Participant Media and Fox Searchlight, the two companies producing the film to do a mini purpose prize. Beginning this month and for the next 6 months, five people will win $5,000 prizes. Five people who have an idea for solving a significant social problem in their community, in the country, globally. There's a competition underway, and one of those lucky individuals who wins will get a trip anywhere in the world with Rhodes Scholar, what used to be known as Elder Hostel. So I'd encourage you to, the film is being billed as a re-coming-of-age story, and, and here's an opportunity to have an adventure as part of it.
Is there anyone on this side of the house? Question or comment?
I have one.
Yeah.
My name's Joyce. It's more a comment than a question. I remember you're referring to someone who said something about something becoming clear as the shadows of life descend.
Yes,
and
say this word.
And who was that?
G. Stanley Hall.
Okay, I totally agree with that. 8 years ago, actually, I was diagnosed with lung cancer. And I feel very fortunate to be here. And but along with it, I've gone through the typical stages everybody goes through in life of growing older. But when you face a life-threatening illness as serious as lung cancer, brings things into very sharp focus. And especially now, I'm very aware of my own mortality, even though I'm totally healthy. Mm-hmm. But when you were talking about things that were true in the morning may not be true in the evening, I have really found that with myself that some of the things I believed when I was younger appear kind of foolish to me right now. But what I've noticed is that the really profound self-acceptance I have of my own background, where I came from and where I am in life, and just sort of an ease of living, a kind of an authenticity, a congruence between the internal and the external, for me has become a lot easier despite, you know, whatever I have brought from my earlier life. And so I think this is just, I totally agree with you that this is just such a rich period, and I'm so glad to be here to actually make the most of this. And the whole thing about a legacy is just something that is very important to me. It's like you kind of go, well, why in the hell am I here?
Yeah.
Because there's something I want to share and there's something I want to leave behind. So I want to try to make something of every day that I have to do that.
Well, your point about legacy, I think, is so important. You know, as I was working on this book, I realized that in previous generations, the hope at this period was to leave a legacy. But for so many of us now, your example powerfully, there's a chance to live a legacy. What an opportunity. I hope that will replace the bumper sticker that we used to see, I'm spending my children's inheritance. I want to see it papered over, I'm living my legacy. Thank you.
Maybe that should be the name of the stage, Living Your Legacy.
Yes, yes.
You have a comment?
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm a language tutor, and I've done a lot of retail and many kinds of work, and I found out that the last years, any of these different jobs is very hard to come by, and I see, for instance, let's say retail. Even though I have a very good resume, I wasn't hired the last few years, not even for Christmas season. Mm-hmm. I'd get the same low pay as, you know, a young kid, but instead the young kids are hired. So how I don't have an answer to, you know, I can't retire and I don't know exactly what I'm going to do. And also, what exactly do you mean by legacy, the definition?
Well, on the last part of your question about the definition of legacy, I mean, I think there is really this idea of outliving the self. You know, what are those things that you want to live on beyond? Obviously, much of that happens with family and close friends. There's a researcher at Stanford, a woman named Laura Carstensen, who wrote an absolutely brilliant book came out last year called A Long, Bright Future. And in it, she describes this theory that she calls socio-emotional selectivity, which is a mouthful. But basically, she started doing research varying the length of time left to live. And it turns out that people of any age make the exact same decisions based on how much time they think they have to live. So this started out, she was discovering, you know, all these older people have fewer social connections, and, you know, lots of times it produces hand-wringing about how isolated older people are. Many older people are isolated. But what Carstensen found is that when you actually talk to those people, it was a decision. They didn't want to get together with, you know, Aunt Tessie, who'd been driving them crazy for 14 years. You know, they just stopped returning the phone calls. They decided to focus on the things that are most important in life. And I think for a lot of people, it's relationships. It's also this question of what lives beyond. What are the things that you invest in? On the first question, you know, it used to be 4 or 5 years ago talking about these ideas. It was just a perfect, beautiful thing. You know, not only was there all this talent in the older population, longevity gains, all these things, but vast labor shortages, right? You know, we were never going to find enough people to work in any of these areas. Well, that is not true, obviously, as your experience underscores. And I think the downturn has both made this rewriting of the map of life, the idea of longer working lives, an imperative, and at the same time, an impossibility. And it's very difficult to figure out how that gets resolved over the short term. But I think of this larger question in the society. You hear lots about it being a zero sum and not a win-win, right? Older people are going to displace younger people and so forth. But I think, you know, I always go back to the example of so many women moving into these new roles in the 60s, 70s, and a lot of the same arguments emerged at that point, especially when the economy was struggling. But now we know that the real challenge as a society is to find ways to get the productive potential of as wide a group as possible engaged. And now we're in this transition period. Now, you know, we know there's no way to be competitive globally if we didn't have all these talented women in these roles. And I think 20, 30 years down the road, we'll feel the same way about people in this period that has no name. I think one of the outcomes of all this is that we are really going to change the whole pattern of lives, the distribution of leisure. The idea of, you know, a balloon payment of 30 years of leisure at the end is just not going to work. Could we take 5 of those years and distribute them across the life course in a way that makes sense? In the future, I think young people, knowing that they're going to work longer, will work less. Maybe Social Security will be for young families, right? Maybe people will go to school for 2 years when they're 18 and 2 more when they're 58. I think it's a whole reworking of what a life looks like. There's a guy named Steven Sagmeister, who's a designer, who's coined this phrase of taking a Sagmeister. Every 7 years, he takes one of his years of retirement and takes a Sagmeister. But so until we kind of come up with these new arrangements, it's going to be very tough for the pioneers who are trying to do what you've described.
Hi, I very much appreciate the innovative and inspiring and positive ideas you've offered tonight from so many different sources. However, I work in the field of aging, and I think that we are still wearing a big set of blinders, and that is that longevity is not oftentimes about living to old age healthy and active. Old age oftentimes, and people in their 90s are finding more and more, there is a point at which the body does change, the mind does change, and the challenge becomes you're still alive, but you cannot fully engage in all of these very active ideas that you're discussing. So I think we have to add to the conversation, how do we prepare, how do we learn, and how do we practice this other stage of life? And I think one of the important aspects that I've observed in my work is that we don't prepare to receive the realities and to receive the interdependence and the services, supports, programs that can keep us as comfortable, as engaged, but when the body and the mind have changed dramatically.
Yes, I subscribe completely to what you're saying. In fact, Peter Laslett, who is this wonderful Cambridge historian, died about 10 years ago. He argued that in Britain they needed to create the third age and distinguish it from the fourth age. And he made that argument not because he wanted in any way diminish the fourth age, but he felt that the challenges and opportunities of each of those phases were distinct, and the sooner we address them clearly, in fact, he said we should address the issues of the fourth age always first, that those were the priority. And I agree with him. And at the same time, it's the same people, but it's different stages of their life. It raises another point, too, about the economic disparities, right? I talked before about the futures unevenly distributed. It's already here. I read an article in the Chronicle last year, a cover article about the distribution of longevity in the Bay Area. Asian American women have a life expectancy of 88, African American men, 68. So African American men aren't really living the stage of life. They're dying beforehand. And I think similarly, for people who are moving into this chapter, who are moving into a new phase of work as well as life, many of them are not doing it purely by choice or even by choice at all, but because they need to for economic reasons. And I think there's great opportunities to help people make the transition and in ways that can promote social mobility. My favorite policy innovation is something called Troops to Teachers, which was created after the first Gulf War by a retired Washington University history professor. Saw these sergeants coming back from the Gulf, having a hard time finding their footing. He knew at that point there was a big shortage of teachers, particularly teachers of color in high schools. He thought, wow, these people have just come from the desert working with a bunch of unformed 18-year-olds. Maybe they do okay in the middle of a classroom with some unformed 17-year-olds. And he was right. It's three times the durability of conventional ed school graduates. And it's been for many people who went into the military because they couldn't go to college an opportunity to go back to school to get a degree, oftentimes an advanced degree, to move into a new profession. And I think it's a small program, but it's an opportunity to think about other ways we can help people who are going to have another chapter of life and of work to move up in the world.
Mark, unfortunately, we just have time for one more question. So we have?
I hope this is a good last question for everybody. I'm going to buy your book, but I'd also like to know how I could keep up
tonight
with this
field.
Tonight
we'll be providing the steak knives as well. And the clapper.
Oh, good. 3 years ago it would have been what sort of magazine would we be reading, but now it would be what website do we go to keep up with this wonderful, interesting new field?
Well, what an opportunity to plug Encore.org, our website at Civic Ventures. We're a nonprofit, but it's designed to be a kind of one-stop destination for people who are thinking about these new chapters. The Coming of Age website, the Transition Networks website, our sites are also wonderful. And there are new entrants. Second Act is a great one. Tells stories of people who moving into this stage of life and does it in a way that's not just a glorification, but really, focuses a lot on the real stories of people who are, fumbling forward in this do-it-yourself process. So I think that there are some options on the web now that there weren't even a few years ago.
Our special thanks to Mark Friedman, author of The Big Shift, which is on sale at the outside the doors, for his comments tonight. We also thank our audience here, as well as the listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.